Welcome to Whiskey Cast, the Cask Strength podcast featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 96 for June 17th, 2007. Coming up in a few minutes.
I used to think when we started this that the Scottish industry would look down their noses at us and poo-poo us, but you know, it's been exactly the opposite. They've been very excited about what we're doing.
That's Bill Lark, who could be called the father of Australia's whiskey distillers. 15 years ago, Bill and his wife Lynn started a distillery in Hobart, Australia. Today, Lark Distillery produces not just whiskey, but unique gin, schnapps, and other liqueurs. More with Bill in a few minutes. First, let's look at the news. Isle of Jura has been keeping a quiet profile for the past few weeks, while the United Spirits takeover of White & Mackay has been in the news. But the distillery has three new limited edition bottlings available exclusively at the distillery and the Isle of Jura website. One honors the memory of Delmay Evans, who revived the distillery in 1963. Decades after it closed and was abandoned, he designed the new distillery right down to brand new stills. There's also a new 40-year-old bottling and a heavily peated 1999 edition bottled to commemorate the first Crinan Classic Boat Festival going on this summer. Now, Jura has a distilling history going back to the bootleggers in the 1600s. Templeton, Iowa's distilling history only goes back about 80 years or so, also dominated by bootleggers until the recent introduction of Templeton rye whiskey. The town is celebrating its quasquicentennial this summer, and Templeton Rye is producing its first limited edition bottling to celebrate. It's a hand-bottled and labeled special batch bottled at 44% ABV. If you'd like to find out more about Templeton, check the Whiskey Cast archives for episode 87 from April to hear my interview with distiller Keith Karkoff. By the way, quasquicentennial means 125th anniversary. Just wanted you to think about it for a second. Now for some bad news. There's a drought hitting the Midwestern U.S., and the folks in Lynchburg, Tennessee, are even drier than usual. You'll recall that alcohol can't legally be sold in Lynchburg, the home of Jack Daniel's distillery, but these days rain is almost as rare as a liquor store in Lynchburg. A Nashville TV station reports the spring that supplies water for the distillery is down about a third from its usual level. Now, that spring is the only water source the distillery will use to make Jack Daniel's, and plant manager Jerry Hamilton says his team is working to conserve as much as they can. The distillery is still producing at normal levels for now. Tickets are going on sale now for two new whiskey festivals in San Francisco this fall. Malt Advocate magazine is staging the first Whiskey Fest San Francisco on October 23rd. And the folks behind the Springtime Whiskies of the World Expo in San Francisco are adding a new festival on October 13th. The Independent Spirits Fest will feature only small batch distilleries and independent bottlers. You'll find links to all of these stories on the Whiskey Cast website, along with a complete calendar of events. Coming up over the next few weeks, John Hansel of Malt Advocate hosts a single malt tasting and dinner on the 22nd at the Farmhouse in Emmaus, Pennsylvania. Jeff Topping of Wild Scotsman Whiskey hosts a Wild Scotsman Whiskey Society tasting with Julian Van Winkle at Nicholson's Tavern in Cincinnati on June 27th. The Australian chapter of the Scotch Malt Whiskey Society holds tasting dinners in Sydney on July 2nd and Melbourne on July 14th. And if you have an event you'd like to add to the list, just email me. My email address is comments@whiskeycast.com. Some of the best ideas get hatched over a bottle of whiskey. Bill Lark of Hobart, Australia, hatched one of those ideas years ago, and life hasn't been the same for Bill and his wife, Lynn, ever since.
It's a true story. I was fishing up in the highlands of Tasmania with my father-in-law, and we caught a beautiful 4-pound brown trout. And my father-in-law, being a bit of a canny Scotsman, said, "That'll do us, Bill." He said, "We'll drive back to this lovely old township called Bothwell up in the highlands, and we might ring Margaret and Lynn and see if they'll come up from Hobart and we'll have a barbecue and cook this trout." And I thought that sounded like a good idea. It was a lovely sunny day. We got to Bothwell and we're sitting waiting for Lynn and Margaret to arrive. And Max, when I realised how smart my father-in-law was, he knew it was going to take them an hour or so to get there. So he opened a bottle of malt whiskey. And sitting up in the highlands of Tasmania drinking, I forget what it was, but we were drinking a malt whiskey. And we'd probably had enough of the whiskey to sort of start making comments like, well, why isn't somebody making whiskey in Tasmania? We've got beautiful bar fields all around us, sensational water, perfect climate, peat fields just up the road. We've got everything going for us. And we just started talking on that week with the trout. And I went back to my office in Hobart and spoke to a bloke who had a bottle shop in Huonville and looked at all his whiskies around the shelf. And I said to this guy, Boney, you know, you've got all this wonderful whiskey, but none of it's made in Australia. And he said, oh, well, why don't you take yourself along and see Fred up the road? He used to work for a distillery in Scotland. And so I went up and saw Fred, and he opened a bottle of Cardhu, and we sat and drank the best part of that. And at the end of the bottle, he said, well, look, you really ought to be talking to my son. He's for a company that made stills in Scotland. And so it went. Everywhere I went, people just sort of, I got swept up in this wave of enthusiasm to make whiskey in Tasmania. And so that was back in the mid-1980s. And, you know, sort of towards the end of the 80s, we thought, well, look, we could have a bit of a go at this. And I took myself across to the Roseworthy Wine College in South Australia, where they had a beautiful copper pot still making brandy. They taught me all about running pot stills, and that just got me more enthusiastic. And we came back to Tasmania and applied for and received what was Tasmania's first licensed distillery in over 150 years, back in 1992.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but at that point you really became the first whiskey distiller in Australia in many years too, right?
Yeah, look, for sure. Australia had a history in Victoria in the 1930s. There was a worldwide shortage of what was called scotch around the world. And the Scottish industry were worried that if they didn't come out to Australia and set up a distillery, somebody might start an industry here in Australia. So United Distillers sent out some old stills, bought a property at Corio near Geelong, and started making a blended whiskey. They set up some continuous stills and a pot still, and they made some whiskey. And they did that for about 36 years, I think, the company went for. It always worried me that Corio wasn't ever remembered as being a particularly good whiskey. And I had the fortune to meet the guy who was the general manager when it was closed and had been with the company for over 30 years. He knew that Australia in time could produce a wonderful single malt whiskey. And he was so excited to see what we were doing. Who remembers that the instructions were back in those days to come to Australia, set up a distillery, make as much of it as you can, but no better than the worst whiskey coming out of Scotland. And so its purpose in life was to make a blended whiskey, but they weren't all that fussed about its quality. What the Scottish industry were afraid of was that somebody could start up making good whiskey here and it might challenge them at the time. They thought that at the time they wanted to stay in control of Scotch whiskey. And so Corio was set up for that very reason. And by the time the late 70s came, there was a glut of whiskey around the world, and they perceived no threat to the industry. And the industry was changing in any event. People were starting to develop an interest in single malt whiskey. And so they decided to close Corio down, and all the remaining whiskey stocks from Corio were actually put through a reflux still and then redistilled to make Vickers Gin. And that's the history of Corio. So effectively, when we got our license in 1992, we had to have the Distillation Act of 1901 changed to allow smaller stills. And we received certainly Tasmania's first distillery license since 1839, and arguably the first license to distill malt whiskey in Australia ever.
Tell me about your history since 92, because it looks like you've been making more than just whiskey down there.
Yeah, well, we started making whiskey in 92, and straight away we could tell that, yeah, look, the early spirit we were producing seemed to be of very high quality. Only time would tell in the barrels. So we started laying down some barrels, and we thought, well, this is going to get a bit expensive. What are we going to do in the meantime? And my wife thought she'd like to have a go at making a gin. And we thought if we could make a gin, she might be able to take those to a few shows and sell a bit of gin, and that'll help us pay for the whiskey. But in looking around for suitable botanicals and everything else, we were put onto a Tasmanian native botanical called the pepperberry, Tasmania lanceolata. And people were starting to use it in different food preparations. And one woman, Catherine Brees, well-known foodie here in Tasmania, kept saying to us, why don't you do something with the pepperberries? So Lynn got a hold of some pepperberries and prepared them as if you were going to make a London gin. She crushed them while they were fresh. She steeped them in a strong neutral alcohol, and then she ran them through our 80-litre copper pot still. And she phoned me up and said, you better come home and have a look at this. It's just fantastic. And I walked into the distillery, and there was just this lovely explosion of characters and flavours, and it came from this one botanical, the native pepperberry. Very complex botanical. So Lynn played around with that, and she thought she didn't need to go to a gin with this. This berry on its own was so complex that she could do something with it on its own. And Lynn produced a product that we called Tasmanian Bush Liqueur. And we launched that in 1996 at the Taste of Tasmania. And there was a food writer from Sydney had come down to judge this food festival. And he discovered our bush liqueur, went back to Sydney, wrote it up as Australia's first uniquely Australian spirit, did a half-page story in the Sydney Morning Herald. That day our phone started ringing from all around Australia, and it just changed our lives. This product, we were just making it flat out and selling it everywhere. It took us from, you know, just playing around to see if we could make malt whiskey. It turned us overnight into a commercial distillery. And so having made that, we then, people said to us, well, you live in Tasmania, that's the Apple Isle. Why don't you start making apple schnapps? And at the time we owned a pub in the ski field up at Ben Lomond, and all of the schnapps we had was imported, so we thought we'll have a go. And so we started making apple schnapps, and then we made a sweet apple schnapps, and then we still loved our gin, and Lynn thought she'd go back to making a gin, and so she's made a traditional London gin but added a little bit of a pepperberry in the final distillation, and that just has produced a sensational gin. And from there we went to a vodka, and in there now we've got about 11 different products. Mm.
Sounds like you guys are having a lot of fun with this.
Look, it's terrific. We literally started out, this was a kitchen table enterprise. We now have 7 full-time staff and anything up to about 7 or 8 casual staff, depending on the time of the year. We've just bought 5-acre property on the outskirts of Hobart and built a new distillery where we do all of our large brewing, and it's taken over our lives. It really is quite exciting, and, you know, to think that sort of we're at the leading edge of what is now, a potential burgeoning industry in Australia. We've helped people set up distilleries in Western Australia, Queensland, New South Wales, Victoria. We've just currently helped another chap start up distilling just south of Hobart, and we're consulting to a distillery to set up one in the Highlands of Tasmania, right back at Bothwell, where we first thought of the idea of setting up a distillery. So within the next 6 months, there'll be 6 working distilleries in Tasmania and a number around Australia. And to think we were sort of right at the start of that, we were the ones that had the legislation change to allow small-scale distilling, and it's been very exciting not only to build our own distillery but to help other people start up. It's been wonderful.
Now, tell me about your single malt.
Okay, our single malt. We're lucky enough to have our own peat bog up in the Central Highlands. It's called Brown Marsh Bog, beautiful peat. We buy our malted barley from Cascade Brewery at the moment, and they're using either Franklin barley or Gairdner's barley, so it's a mixture of those barleys. Beautiful malt. They make their Cascade Premium lager with it, which is a world-known beer. So it's good quality brewing barley. We peat smoke about 50% now of that malted barley. We developed our own technique for peat smoking the malted barley. And we currently use an ale yeast for fermentation. So we brew in an open mash tun, like in the traditional old way, and using the Nottingham ale. So we produce a whiskey that's lightly peated and has a very nice balance on the finish with the malt and the peat. We've now just bought our own cooperage, and we have been using mostly old port barrels that we've sourced from the mainland, and our cooper in the day used to cut them down to 100 litres for us. He would shave them and re-toast them so that our whiskey had this just delightful little background character of almost Christmas pudding-like port. We've now bought that cooperage and making our own barrels, and we're sourcing sherry barrels from New South Wales, and we also do a number of bourbon barrels. We bought a container load of bourbon barrels from Jack Daniels, and we're using those as well.
I heard about you guys basically because somebody told me that you guys were producing the only peated whiskey in the Southern Hemisphere.
Yeah, that's right.
Go ahead.
When we and we all started, we'd buy our malt from somewhere, you know, of course, the malting houses for the breweries didn't want to know anything about peat. So we had this problem of how do we get peat, because traditionally they used to create their malt in Scotland over a peat fire. So we thought about it and came up with a solution of post-smoking the malt. And we developed our own peat furnace and came up with a technique of introducing the peat smoke phenols into the malted barley without altering the character of the barley. And that's been working an absolute treat. So, yeah, we started producing peat smoked malt right back in the early 90s. As other distilleries came on board, they didn't have the opportunity to brew their own wash. They were buying their wash from breweries. And so they didn't have any ability to influence the malted barley. There's a distillery in northern Tasmania that since bought a load of peated malt from the UK and made one batch of peated malt spirit, and they've been blending that with their unpeated malt. And there's a distillery in Victoria that's about to start brewing his own wash, and he's been playing around with introducing a bit of peat into his whiskey as well. So there'll be, out of all the distilleries, some will be clearly unpeated, and a few more are now sort of having introducing some peat smoke to their whiskey, yeah.
Now, I have to ask, how does your peated whiskey compare in, say, peatiness to an Islay whiskey?
Yeah, look, I don't know how we rate in parts per million, but I'd say we'd be somewhere between, if you know a Talisker, how that's got a nice balance of peat, somewhere between Talisker and a lightly peated Bowmore. So it's not a dominant character of peat, but that's in the whiskies that we're releasing now. And back in those days, we were only peat smoking about 20% of our malt. We're currently peat smoking 50% of our malt, but that whiskey won't be available for a number of years yet. But the raw spirit tastes, if you tried the Ardbeg Nambeastie, you know, that lovely sort of, it's not as heavily peated as their 10-year-old, and it's got a nice little light sweetness to it. Our raw spirit reminds me very much of that Ardbeg Nambeastie, but I don't know what will happen after it's been in a barrel for 5 years or so in these small barrels. That might soften up a little bit, but that's going to be exciting to see.
Hmm. Well, being in the range somewhere between a Talisker and a Bowmore is a pretty good place to be.
Oh, that's what we're aiming for, yeah. Hmm.
Now, are you exporting any of your whiskey?
Yes, we are. Our biggest problem has been that in our early days, we just simply didn't make enough of it. We just weren't sure what the reaction to our whiskey would be. The reaction has been surprising, and the demand has been quite high, and we found that we've just about every time we release a barrel, it gets snapped up very quickly. So we haven't been able to sort of, we've let a little bit go to, some went to the UK a year or so back. We've got some on the ship to Canada at the moment where they're going to be having a look at it over there. And we're just negotiating to send some to Denmark and Sweden. We can only afford at the moment to release small shipments of our whiskey, just enough to sort of get some out into the marketplace around the world because there's a lot of interest in what we're doing here in Tasmania. That'll change for us over the next 12 months where we'll get to a point where we can start releasing more whiskey for export. What we're doing at the moment is just sort of soft launching our whiskey into a few small markets just to sort of see how it goes.
Tell me about the Slange whiskey that you make.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's another thing my wife has done. She took some of our matured malt whiskey, and then in that small 80-litre copper pot still, she distilled some different herbs and spices and produced a lovely spirit that she then married with the single malt whiskey and brought to a level of sweetness, nothing as sweet as Strambuie or some of those ones, but just a very pleasant level of sweetness, and that's been an absolute walk-off-the-shelf hit, just fantastic. Yeah, it's a real winner for us. Mm.
Has this been everything you expected it would be when you first started?
No, it's everything and more. We honestly, when we started, we said all we wanted to do, we loved our malt whiskies. All we wanted to do was to see if Tasmania was capable of producing a good single malt whiskey. And I was a surveyor in private practice and we had a family. We had no other intentions than that, but the exciting thing is that it's taken over our lives, and other people are getting involved. And I took a contract with another distillery, one of the other ones in Tasmania, 7 years ago. I took a contract with them for a year. It changed hands, and they saw what we were doing, and the new owners asked me to come down and help them improve the whiskey and the volume. And so I trained up 4 new distillers, and we distilled around the clock. And one of those whiskies, I'm very excited to say, that we made nearly 7 years ago, has just been declared in the, if you look in Whiskey Magazine, they looked at a whiskey called Sullivan's Cove. Now, it had a bit of a history in the past, but the whiskey that I made 7 years ago just received the best of the other whiskies in the world. Jim Murray looked at the same whiskey and wrote it up in his latest whiskey Bible at 95 points. I think out of 3,600 whiskeys around the world, there were only 5 or 6 other whiskeys score higher than 95 points, and he raved about it. And so, for me, it is just an amazing accolade from the Scottish industry to think that whiskies we've made only 7 years ago are receiving such reviews. And it's just, and it says to me, and it says to the rest of the world that yes, we can make very good malt whiskey here in Tasmania.
Boy, that sounds wonderful. That's a really high honour for you. Congratulations.
Well, it really is. Thank you very much. Yeah, no, we're very excited with that. But listen, I've got to say that we've had, I used to think when we started this that the Scottish industry would look down their noses at us and poo-poo us. But, you know, it's been exactly the opposite. They've been very excited about what we're doing and very helpful. And we've got many, many friends in the Scottish industry that have been only too willing to help us along the way. So it really is a nice thing to think that we're producing a good whiskey that not only we can be proud of, but they're also proud of it too.
By the way, if you find yourself in Tasmania, Bill offers tours of his distillery in Hobart. You'll find a link to the Lark Distillery website at whiskeycast.com. And if you'd like to find out more about Sullivan's Cove, check the Whiskey Cast archives for episode 61 from last October, when I interviewed current Sullivan's Cove master distiller Patrick McGuire. Finally, it's Father's Day weekend here in the U.S. If you're a dad or a single mom that has to be both mom and dad, well, here's to you. And here's to my dad, Phil, and my father-in-law, Gary, as well. That's all for this episode of Whiskey Cast. My email address for questions and suggestions is comments@whiskeycast.com. And there's still time to submit your questions for the first question and answer episode coming up in a few weeks, where I'll put your questions to the whiskey experts. Whiskey Cast is a production of MG Media, copyright 2007, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.